Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00080. Recorded on May the 9th, 2024. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Of Wisdom, Part 2. Earls of Wisdom, Part 2. Chapter 80.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88. This monologue is continued from the previous episode, Chapter 00079, Earls of Wisdom, Part 1.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back to the continuation of Earls of Wisdom, right? This is Part 2, Earls of Wisdom. Now, so far, we have only managed to address a singular Earl, right? Who isn't even really an Earl, he's a Trevor, right? But my wife and I, he's Earl, and spent a lot of time expounding on the virtues of trailers and trailer park and trailer park culture, right? So when you start to put these things together, also talked much about the California desert, right? The Salton Sea out in Imperial County, California. So you kind of got this triad developing itself, whereas we're speaking much about California, where this is really a Texas-oriented program, but you know Texas by now has been Californicated, very much so, blossoming out of Austin first and foremost, because, yeah, let's go after the state government and the state governmental policies and handouts and everything. That's where all the liberals turn up. So we have our little version of San Francisco in Texas, and then they try to pull the same crap in the other larger cities around. But it really hasn't taken so much yet there, and it may not. I don't know. We'll see. But anyway, yeah. This triad going on, just developing, is about Earls, it's about trailer parks, and it has to do with California, right? Put all the three Earls together, and what do you get? You get a conversation between my wife and I going back a few weeks, where a TV show from the 2000s came up, right? The decade, the 2000s, the zeros, whatever you call that. I don't know what you call that. From 2000 to 2009, right? The 2000s. Somewhere in there, I think it was, what was it, 05, 06, 07, 08. I think these were when four seasons of a television show on NBC, of all places, which really doesn't make sense to me. But anyway, a television show called, and I quote, My Name is Earl, right? My Name is Earl. That was the name of a TV show. Kind of based on a character that was named Earl Hickey, right? Earl Hickey. Turned out that it was like a favorite, if not the favorite, television show of my wife. And I never knew that. I never knew that. I liked it. I've seen it probably to the point of the conversation I had with her, probably two times in its total four season run, you know, like binge watching that, like I have a tendency to do binge watch. I've been through it at least two times, and I saw some of the episodes as they were being released week to week. As it turned out, I was living in Georgia at the time. I had a girlfriend who had a couple of three teenage daughters, and they watched that show. So while I was hanging around with them, I would get to see My Name is Earl every once in a while. So it's not new to me. And in fact, I liked it very much. I had a little squabble with it. You know, I had a little squabble. I'll get into this as we go. But the show itself will help a person like me get over that squabble. And I got a secondary squabble, which is really relegated to the fourth season. They were expecting a fifth season. It was a very popular show, but it just got cut off kind of surprisingly, right? Kind of got surprisingly short, cut short. A little bit of a cliffhanger that never was totally resolved, if I remember right. But the fourth season of My Name is Earl started to get a little bit gay, you know? So you can tell the ideas were really not coming anymore. And they probably brought some new people into the mix to try to generate creativity. And those people probably were gay, right? Because the content got gayer and gayer. And you start losing me in that. You know, you do. The first three seasons, great. The first season especially, excellent, right? It kind of went downhill season by season. But the first three seasons were really good enough to watch and rewatch. Season four got stupid. A jump in the shark sort of thing, right? It just, they ran out of creative ideas, it seemed to me. And cutting it off at that point probably saved a lot of people a lot of bother, because the season five, the way that was developing, it was going to suck. But up to that point, really good TV, surprisingly on actual network television. This would seem to be something better suited for the Nashville network or country music television, you know, some real redneck stuff, or just some kind of cable network in general, rather than, you know, the major network TV options, which I have nothing to do with anymore anyway. But anyway, My Name is Earl, right? My Name is Earl. My Name is Earl is an American television sitcom created by some guy named Greg Garcia that aired on the NBC television network. Here's the actual dates: from September 20th, 2005 to May 14th, 2009. I generally had it about right there. In the United States. Produced by 20th Century Fox Television. It starred Jason Lee as Earl Hickey, the title character. And had a couple of other stars too. Let's see, most episodes from the first season, then only a few from the rest, began with Earl presenting the premise of the series. You know, the kind of guy who does nothing but bad things and then wonders why his life sucks. Well, that was me. Every time something good happened to me, something bad was always waiting around the corner. Karma. The karma thing is what I initially have issue with. It's kind of a misuse of karma. I don't believe in karma. And I'll probably get into that as we go. Let me continue reading here. From the know-it-all, Wikipedia, right? The racist Wikipedia, if you've been following me. Everything turns out about race here. These content creators are, I don't know, their mind must be drifting off with their reefer between their Pop-Tarts and their cheese puffs into all kinds of racial insanity. But anyway, let me move on from that. That pisses me off. Let me move on. So I made a list of everything bad I've ever done, and one by one, I'm going to make up for all my mistakes. I'm just trying to be a better person. My name is Earl, right? So with the basic premise, you really got a guy who's going after redemption, right? Redemption. That's a big deal. That's a very big deal. And anytime somebody is pursuing redemption, you start to get into morality, right? In fact, you know, I'm the kind of guy that always did bad things but expected good to come my way, right? Well, what the hell is good and bad? So you've heard me go about this. You need some kind of foundational worldview to establish that which is good from that which is not good or bad or evil or whatever, right? So you've already got the premise of good and evil established in My Name is Earl. And whichever way they go with it from here in terms of quote-unquote religion, which they really don't. They really don't pursue much of a religion. There is God involved. You'll see when Earl talks about karma, he looks up into the sky, right? He's looking for a God above. But he expresses this God in terms of the quote-unquote universe, right? This universal force, which it is, which God really is. But call it what it is. Call God what God is. Call God God, right? The creator of all things. God Almighty, the creator of all things. You're saying a lot when you say those words. And it's a start. But anyway, so it doesn't really get specifically religious, but it does incorporate a man's pursuit of redemption, and it does incorporate a great creative force beyond our limited world, right? So it's a good start. And having that foundation built into the premise always has some kind of theological lesson pulsating. Now, here's some specifics about Earl Hickey as a character, right? Okay, again, he's a main character. I'm going to say it right now, okay? Because anytime you have like a quote-unquote main character in any kind of TV show, movie, something like that, I think the automatic assumption is that's the person that everything kind of revolves around. Like, he's the centrifugal focus of everything that happens socially inside the storyline. But in this case, it's not so. It's a little bit weird, and you might not recognize it unless you're really paying attention, right? My Name is Earl. Yes, it kind of follows this course of redemption that a character named Earl Hickey is proceeding through step by step, episode by episode, you know, resolving the error of his ways in the past and trying to smooth out a more polished, better positive future, right? But the base of characters involved, see, now I said there's a triad involved that led us to My Name is Earl, right? Talking about Earl, talking about California, talking about trailer parks. See, My Name is Earl encompasses all three of those elements, right? My Name is Earl, filmed on location in Van Nuys, N-U-Y-S, I think that's how you say it, I don't know, California, right? Which is out in the valley north of Hollywood, over the Hollywood Hills into pornography land, right? That's where all the pornography is created in this country. You know, the Hollywood Hills, and the valley and Hollywood itself. Oh, that is the Talmudic paradise built with the hands of all that is immoral, right? So anyway, moving on from that, this trailer, Earl didn't live in a trailer park. At one point in his life, he did. He was married to this woman named Joy. They shared a trailer together. She got rid of him for another guy, and he moved into a motel with his brother, right? So he lives in a motel room, and Joy lives in a trailer park. And really, the society that is involved with the story evolves around the character Joy much more than it is about Earl, right? And I'm talking the society of characters involved. She is the queen bee that everything kind of spins around. And one of the things spinning around in its own orbit is this Earl guy who just happens to be on his path to redemption and has a TV show kind of focused on that path. But he is not the center of his own universe. He's stuck to this Joy woman for any of a bunch of different reasons, right? But she's the center. She's the center. She's what I call the drama queen bee. And I'll get into that as we go a little bit. I'm really getting ahead of myself right here. Let's talk about Earl, right? Earl Hickey, the titular viewpoint character, right? That's how they describe him, the viewpoint character. He has a long history of petty crimes and other repugnant acts of bullying classmates and taking advantage of others. In the opening episode, he wins a lottery scratcher but is immediately hit by a car. During his recovery, where he catches a Carson Daly interview, where the latter talks about karma, he realizes he has been a bad person and tries to turn his life around by making a list of all the bad things he has done and doing good deeds to cross them off the list. He discovers that when he does good things, he is rewarded by karma. See, there's that whole pursuit of rewards for doing good. Instead of doing good just to do good, right? This is that pursuit of quote-unquote blessings that I mentioned in prior episodes, and I may mention again as we go along. I probably will, right? We misconstrue blessings from God as things of material wealth and value, right? Of easier and better living. This is not what faith is all about. This is not what goodness is about. Goodness is, and faith is opposite of it. It is a matter of sacrifice. It is a matter of hardship. And with that, meekness. If you've ever heard me speak about meekness before, right? Like the meek shall inherit the earth. That's actually Bible, right? That's from the Beatitudes in Matthew 5, right? And at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, right? The Beatitudes. The meek shall inherit the earth. Also borrowed from the prog rock, the Canadian prog rock band Rush on their 2112 album. Meekness is not weakness. And this is another mistake people have in their perception of things. Meekness is the strength you have to abide by the faith you have allied yourself with, right? I say for me, I believe in Jesus Christ. That means I will hold on to that faith no matter what happens unto my death. All right, so that takes strength. That takes strength of will. That takes courage, right? Meekness is not weakness. The blessings that we get from God, and we do, are things that we need to accomplish His ends, not our own, right? God may find it within His will to provide us comfort when we are hurting, so we have the ability to get back up and help the next person. See what I'm saying? But it's not for our simple pleasure. We are not being healed of our ills so we can go off and just enjoy life. You know? You get a raise, get a little extra money. Hey, let's go buy a sailboat, and instead of working with others towards bringing Christ into the lives of others, helping people who are down without any ulterior motives, just doing it, almsgiving as the Orthodox do, as I do, just for the sake of it, because it is the quote-unquote right thing to do, you know, and we don't need reasons otherwise, but the reasons, and I explained it in a previous episode, it's part of what opens up our channels of communion with God. It really connects us with God, with this thing Earl Hickey calls karma, right? With this thing Earl Hickey describes maybe as the universe. Our blessings, like I said, are all about the strength and ability to go and help the next person. Previous episode, one more time, I talked about in my life finally becoming a giver rather than a taker, right? Getting myself into a position. I followed along. I didn't get myself into a position. I found myself in a position where I'm able to give. I give of myself in so many different ways, and I don't need to be taken anymore, right? I made that transition, and the hope is that everybody eventually makes that transition. Jesus Christ taught us in Scripture that there will always be the poor, right? There will always be a poor. Take the time right now to focus on me when you have me present. That's what Jesus says to His apostles, right? But the fact of the matter is there will always be poor people. There will always be that kind of suffering. There will be always that kind of strife and struggle. Therefore, there always needs to be people who are there to help those people, right? We go hand in hand, givers and takers. It's a fact of existence. But what we're giving is opportunity to come to Christ. And then when people come to Christ, you give them all the means of holding on with both hands and never letting go of it. Because you can do that. But I don't want to start arguing all the Protestants out there. So anyway, that was a little bit of a long jagged runoff about, you know, matters of faith where it pertains to what blessings are. And I could even go into more about this. I may do it. It's always pissed me off. That's why I get a little bit animated about it. I see so many people turning to God as a means of, prosperity. You've heard of the prosperity gospel. I'll bring that shit up later too, right? So there's a little tinge of that involved with Earl Hickey's path of redemption. You see what I'm saying? He's doing it. Why? So he can have it good instead of bad. He's got all the bad luck, you know, the just desserts of his works, of his fruit, coming back at him, and he's had enough of that shit. He's doing things so he has a smooth ride from here on out, right? There's no part of, there's this part of him that are making things right for the past, but there's not this part of him that is sacrificing his life for the future. So there's an incompleteness to this understanding of redemption as far as Earl Hickey is concerned, right? My name is Earl, as opposed to Trevor Phillips Earl from Grand Theft Auto 5. Where did I leave off here in this know-it-all Wikipedia racist scumbag bitch? He discovers when he does good things, he is rewarded by karma, right? That's where I left off. First, by getting the lottery ticket back. But when he ignores the list, as especially demonstrated in the episode The Professor, which is actually the episode that kind of cleared shit up as far as karma is concerned. Let me take a little side jag here, okay? Talking about this episode The Professor. One of my problems, as I stated, with My Name is Earl, is this whole pursuit of quote-unquote karma, and the fact that what he's calling karma is very much misunderstood, misplaced, misused. It's not karma that he's really talking about here. It's more in the lines like what I just said, like prosperity gospel. Karma involves past lives, future lives, right? What you do in this life affects your next life. What you did in your previous life is why you're suffering your toil now. So you get into a whole theology of your soul recurring on planet Earth in the third dimension, right? Which is completely opposed to Christian understanding, right? It's completely different. So when we use that karma actually comes out of Hinduism, right? That's actually a Hindu term. It's actually a Hindu concept. Now you're getting into polytheistic stuff, which puts yourself on the side of anti-religion. When you're talking about religion versus anti-religion, which I do. That's actually the book I'm trying to write as time permits, right? Religion and anti-religion. You have a true religion, which is the religion of the Creator God, as He mandated things to be. And you have an anti-religion, which is the religion of the demons that rebelled against God and was handed to Cain and went down through humanity in that chain. This is not a blood thing. Never get confused about Cain and the bloodline of Cain. It's not about blood. It's always going to be about what you believe. It's really a matter of what you believe about God Almighty, the Creator of all things. You're with Him or you're not with Him. All right, it's that simple. It all breaks down. So you got religion on the one hand, you got anti-religion on the other hand. Hinduism, polytheistic, is non-Christian, anti-Christian, is absolutely anti-religion. Now you get an understanding of where my problem with this whole quote-unquote karma thing is. All right, karma really is a Hindu concept, and I'm not down with it, and it is so blatantly misused, especially as Earl Hickey is doing it. I don't expect more from Earl Hickey because he doesn't know shit about faith, this character, right? But he seems to be learning as he goes. So you stick with it episode after episode. And like I said, it went gay in the fourth season, but it could have went religious. And it could have been something really special. The creators blew it. They missed an opportunity. But they probably don't understand either, right? Because life begets art. Art imitates life. And you've got writing creators that just obviously didn't quite get it all. They got something, but they didn't get it all. So my problem with this concept, this misuse of the idea of karma, was addressed by this professor. What the professor was a college professor, a young woman, late 20s, early 30s, very pretty, you know, completely outclassing this trailer park Earl Hickey guy. But they kind of fell for each other. They just, something happened. They were attracted to each other. And it happens in life. You kind of get into somebody who is like not your class of people. I was talking about comfort levels, you know, with the quote unquote trailer trash. You know, me and my wife, we're kind of more comfortable with people who are low on the economic totem pole than we are with people who are not, right? And I've been like that just about forever. But then every once in a while, it just happens. You know, I had I don't like deviating and talking about like ex-girlfriends and things like that, because my wife listens to this, right? I don't mean to harp on it, but I'm telling you, this shit happens. And it happened to me where some girl just fell crazy for me long before I even knew it, right? I was dating this one girl, which was a psycho witch who I've mentioned before. And when I broke up with her, waiting in the wings, right? A girl who I had met while I was dating the other one, she kind of had a thing going for me that I didn't know about. And the minute opportunity presented itself, she threw herself into my life. And she was a really good catch for me at that time, as things were. I mean, nobody compares to my wife, and nobody ever could. My wife is perfect for me in so many, every way. You know, it's innumerable, but it contains everything. And no other woman will ever be that, right? But as far as the other women in my life were concerned, you know, this one ranks up there. And it's most likely because I never really gave it time to get all screwed up, right? The red flags never really showed themselves. But what I'm trying to say here is, I have good memories of this person, and that's good, and I'm happy to leave it like that. But B, primarily what I'm trying to say is, sometimes in life, we step into relationships, you know, romantic involvements with people who completely outclass us, right? And this was the case. This girl, she called me, told me to come up to her house. Here's my address, here's directions, right? This is before the smartphone era, right? You actually had to know where you're going before you got there. No GPS or anything like that, right? So, because it was a long time ago. I'm old, right? So anyway, it was in the town where I grew up, but I never even knew that road was there, right? I go down this road, and all the way to the end, it's like this private lane, this dirt road. I get to the end of it, there's this humongous mansion, right? Ginormous. In all my life, I have never stepped into a larger home than that thing, right? And that's where she lived. That's where she grew up. She had a father, a mother, and a brother, and a dog. And they lived in like this mansion. I don't know. It looked like it must have had like 20 bedrooms in it. It was just crazy, right? I may be exaggerating it, but it was humongous. And it was all ornate, and it was just wow. And part of the reason that I walked away from that relationship, and I'm not going to get into the whole story of it, but was the overwhelm I had. And what kind of expectations is this person ultimately going to have of me? You know, I know a girl, a woman's propensity, her matronly desire to take a ruffian like I was and polish him up and make him into a good man, capable enough to provide for her, you know, everything that she needs. And give her the security, you know, defend her, all that stuff, right? To make me into the man that she wants me to be. And I'm like, man, I'm not with this gazillionaire mansion. I'm talking mansion. I'm not talking McMansion, all right? I'm not talking just a big old house. This was a mansion. This is like a tornado would hit this place and walk away whimpering after it got its ass kicked, right? The house wasn't going down. This is like a 1,000-year house, right? You know what I mean? Like the homes in Europe. You know, they build the castles and things like that. Whatever comes by, those things stand. I was completely outclassed. And there was no part of me that felt like I deserved on any level to have somebody who grew up like that, right? So it happens. So we go back to my name is Earl with the professor, right? And the professor was the one who was knowledgeable enough to recognize that Earl was misusing his concept of karma and explained what it was, right? And he, you know, nodded his head like he did, raised his one eyebrow like he does. He's got these certain inflections and mannerisms. And, you know, if you watch it, you'll see it. You'll get it. You'll understand what I'm saying about it. Not really important. But he still carried on the same way about karma going forward, even after that, even knowing it. But after that point, it started to become more of like a looking to the sky thing, like I described. So this professor woman did something, and it turned out that they couldn't be together because it was conflicting with his redemption, which is something else that happens in life, right? You come to Jesus, and then all of a sudden, like, the devil starts throwing his daughters at you, right? And you make off with one of those, and quote-unquote karma has a way of smacking you down. And then you get back in line and start pursuing your redemption again. And then another daughter of the devil shows up, right? I don't know how many times that's happened to me. I got the one stupid rich woman one time, but I've got the daughters of the devil disrupting my redemption multiple times, right? So these things happen. These things are true. These things are absolutely realistic. And I think that was an important episode, you know. It got a little bit silly because everybody ended up getting massively stung by bees and their faces disfigured and everything like that. But again, it's a comedy. Ultimately, it's a comedy. But it's just got this strain of serious contemplation built into its foundational premise, right? It's a good show. It's a good show. First three seasons. Then, like I said, it loses its way. So, but when he ignores a list, as especially demonstrated in the episode The Professor, bad things continue to happen. One of the recurring gags regarding Earl is that he's always has his eyes closed when somebody takes a picture of him, right? He has a mustache and tends to wear flannel shirts, although in his past he also wears concert t-shirts from classic rock bands. He's a huge fan of southern rock and heavy metal bands, so I relate, right? I relate on that level also. AC/DC, Def Leppard, Motorhead, Judas Priest, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Van Halen, Guns N' Roses, Iron Maiden, and Metallica. He drives a 1973 red El Camino that once belonged to his friend Frank. Has a blue driver's side door found in a tornado. Right? And that gives you like a little bit of the gist of Earl Hickey, right? He's got the aw shucks factor. You know what that is? You probably don't, because I'm the, you know, that's a Maverick 88 dictionary term. Aw shucks factor is kind of like that southern kind of redneck, bad boy with the good side to him. Aw shucks factor. It's like Elvis had the aw shucks. He was like the bad guy. He swiveled the hips. He was generating that rock and roll music, and all the girls were going crazy over him, you know. There was something immoral and base about what was happening around this guy. But then somebody would interview him, and he was just like this, you know, simple southern Christian boy that just wanted to sing gospel music. And yeah, the bad things he does and the women and all that, he just can't help himself. You know, that's kind of it. You know, it's like the devil made me do it kind of thing. I'm a good guy, but the devil made me do it. And the girls just love that shit. They just love that shit, right? And like I was talking about before, it's that person that won't, you know, the matronly maternal instinct of women to take a ruffian boy, a ruffian man, and polish it up and make him something useful, right? Just when you have the aw shucks factor in a guy like that, the good is evident. So you know you can work with that bad, and the good is already there. You're not talking about somebody who is like a total reprobate who has no hope of goodness in him. So I think it's these components, when you bring them together in a guy, makes girls just crazy. And of course, then they got to be handsome and everything like that. And all the guys, you go back to that Memphis rock and roll stuff, you know, I thought Elvis. He had his cousin Jerry Lee Lewis, who was the same sort of dude, right? He's the guy who dreamed about being a Protestant pastor. He wanted to be a preacher, but he just kept on tripping over his own feet and ended up banging away on a rock and roll piano. you know, and had all this crazy lust after the girls and had to drink a little bit, you know, and just couldn't help himself. The devil made me do it, right? He had that about him. And that was like the thing, that original rock and roll music that was coming out of Memphis, you know, Sun Records and all that stuff. It just had that good and bad mix together. And I'm talking, and that's what I call the all shucks factor. All shucks. I hope I drew a concise enough picture. You know, it's funny, they mention about wearing concert t-shirts, right? And he does throughout it. But almost every episode, Earl's wearing a Lynyrd Skynyrd t-shirt, right? Leonard's, and it, when I look at that, I just think, you know, when I was a kid growing up, I was like, end of sixth grade, in the seventh grade, I had a Lynyrd Skynyrd concert t-shirt. Now, I didn't get to go to a Lynyrd Skynyrd concert. They had, you know, their infamous plane crash happened even a little bit before I've ever heard of them, right? 1977, I started listening to them probably in 79, I would guess. First album I ever bought, Lynyrd Skynyrd, with my own money, on my own volition, pedaling my own bicycle, right? I tell the story all the time. Lynyrd Skynyrd, pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd. And if I was to be sent off to a desert island and I can only take one album with me, I'm probably taking that one. And Lynyrd Skynyrd is serious business with me, right? I totally relate to that. But I had that shirt. That was my favorite shirt that I probably ever owned in my whole life. I loved it. It had the old, the Bones, right? The Bones font lettering for Lynyrd Skynyrd on it, like the original, you know, the first album did. And those are hard to find. I'm actually thinking about replacing that shirt finally after all these years. I probably got like 3 years out of it. I don't think it survived my freshman year. Shit, I didn't survive my freshman year. I think I had seventh grade, eighth grade, and into ninth grade somewhere. I think it just evaporated, you know. I had clothes that were quote unquote mysteriously disappearing. Now, I think my mother or father, somebody was throwing them out as they were, like, the laundry was being done. You know, like you have the mystery disappearing sock. You're always missing a sock and you wonder where the hell the sock went. Well, I was having these disappearing shirts happen, and Lynyrd Skynyrd shirt happened to be one of those. I don't know who's responsible. But I remember that shit. But anyway, all these years later, now I'm thinking about replacing that, but I can't find a shirt that has that lettering on it. Well, I found one of it, but it's like a 50th anniversary thing. Going back to 1973, which is weird because the band got together in 65. So I just don't like the math of it all. It ain't right. And plus, it's a white shirt. It's black on white. I want white on black is what I want. I would like a Lynyrd Skynyrd t-shirt that was just black. And it just said Lynyrd Skynyrd across it, left to right, in that Bone font, right? That's all. That's all I want. The simplest thing. Can't find it nowhere. Nowhere, right? Earl Hickey, also, he sports a mustache, right? He sports a mustache, which is kind of a traditionally redneck slash trailer trash kind of thing. Think about like NASCAR, right? NASCAR, you had Richard Petty in the 70s, Dale Earnhardt after that into the 80s and 90s. And in amongst that, you had Burt Reynolds, the actor, who did all those racing type of movies, you know, speeding around, you know, redneck kind of drama, right? And comedy. Good stuff. Smokey and the Bandit, for example, right? But he had that mustache. And even the comedian, Jeff Foxworthy, right? Guy from Georgia. In fact, I used to drive by his house when I was going to AA meeting out there. I was in an AA club the years I lived in Georgia. Jeff Foxworthy lived right down the neighborhood. Jeff Foxworthy, he's the one who's famous for the "you might be a redneck if" type of comedy, right? These one-liners that are really good. But he had the mustache too. And it was kind of like, I remember I talked about the girl from Georgia who I was dating at one time who had the kids, and that's where I was watching My Name is Earl. She had a brother, right? She had an older brother. We would go down to Valdosta a couple of times in the course of the time that I was with her. She had family down there. And amongst her family was her brother, and her brother had one of the, they're like 70s porn star mustaches. Let's just call them what they are, right? But the guys in the South, from that era, 70s, 80s, into the 90s, had a tendency of growing them. Like, my whole life, I think there was only one time where I actually had just a mustache, like without a beard, without a goatee or anything like that. To me, it was always weird, right? I did it, and I only did it for like a week or two, and then I got rid of it. It just seemed weird to me. I always have to have like at least a goatee, if not a full beard on top of it, right? So, but all these guys, you know, Richard Petty and Dale Earnhardt and Burt Reynolds and Jeff Foxworthy, these are synonymous with Southern men and redneckedness and, I hate to say it, maybe even trailer trash, white trash. I really hate that racial connotation. But yeah, I mean, Earl Hickey is a character, and he's based on stereotype, right? So he's emblematic of your typical trailer park dude. And I'm not going to say they did a bad job doing it, really. I think they did a good job doing it, the creators of the show, developing that character. So, anyway, more about Earl Hickey and karma, I guess. With Earl Hickey, as I explained before, right, there's this process of redemption that he goes through as every new episode evolves through the series. My name is Earl, right? And this evolving redemption process is nothing less than a search for God. And I got this kind of, there's this idea. I call it provincial spirituality, right? And what I mean to say by that is it's kind of like a trail mix of concepts, right? Of spiritual concepts, of theological concepts. By trail mix, I mean just literally a mix. A little bit of this, a little bit of that. You all put it in a bag and you take it with you where you go. Here's the idea. Like you're taking a little from here, taking a little from there, and you're kind of making your own Frankenstein religion out of it. Do you understand what I'm saying? Right? So there's a provincial version of that. And it gets expressed here and there, bit by bit, in this spot and that spot, as you go through My Name is Earl, right? Episode after episode. I don't have particular examples off the top of my head that happened in that show, but I'll give you an idea how it happens, right? Once upon a time, I don't know it still exists. I don't think it does. I think the guy died. I don't know. I was never a fan. I always thought it was hokey and stupid. I mean, beyond hokey. Really beyond stupid. Jerry Springer, right? And the shit that he would roll out on his shows. It was a talk show. He was the host, and he'd bring out basically what we would call quote-unquote trailer trash people and, you know, create havoc, create arguments. You'd bring out a guy and his girlfriend, and then you'd bring out the bitch that he'd been sleeping with, right? And then the two women would fight with each other, like a brawl right there on the stage in front of a live audience and everything like that. And that was a show, the Jerry Springer Show. And he had these certain kind of talk shows, right? Things that are on TV. Let me take one quick step back. Trailer park life. You are impoverished, basically, right? You're in the low income class. And with that is often things like unemployment, welfare. And with unemployment and welfare, what do you have? A lot of time on your hands, right? And what do you do when you have a lot of time on your hands? Well, people can get busy with hobbies. People can volunteer. Churches, hospitals, and all kinds of things like that, right? People can work at trying to find a job. And then when they find a job, work at that. But when you got all kinds of times on your hands, a lot of people just kind of devolve into sitting in front of the television set for hours on end. So you get the daytime TV, which involves things like Jerry Springer, but it also involves things like Oprah Winfrey and Dr. Phil and all this. And I'm not really, really familiar with all this stuff. I've got a little inclination, a little taste of it here and there throughout the years, because years and years of this shit has already happened, right? But these kind of shows, they'll bring people in who are trying to sell a book or something like that. They'll interview and you know, it's always some kind of, well, I shouldn't say always, it's never, never, and it's all, whatever, never always, and never, never, that's horrible communication, by the way. I catch myself doing that more frequently than I'd like to admit to, and you get to hear it here, right, live before no studio audience, but live before studio audiences are things like Dr. Phil and Oprah and Jerry Springer, now I say, And this practice hasn't stopped, right? People who host radio shows and television shows, they get interviews by allowing people to what we call plug, right? Quote unquote, plug their wares. If they wrote a book, now they're going to sell the book. And they sell the book by getting on and explaining concepts about the book on a given show. Now, if you're some kind of like New Age occultist and you put like together, for example, like a new way of divining tarot cards, right? A new layout, a new spread that you can use for whatever reason, right? And you got a book that you wrote about it. Now, Oprah or somebody like that will have you on daytime TV and you'll explain spirituality through that lens while you're trying to sell that book. And you've got all these people in trailer parks with time on their hands because they got no job, they got no money, whatever, no interest, no hobbies. And they learn a little something about tarot cards, right? And then they turn the channel and then there's somebody else doing the same thing, but they got a whole new take on who Jesus is, right? And they turn the channels again. There's a televangelist down there and the telephone rings and they get up and they answer the phone. And then they get done with their phone call, they put the phone down, they decide they're going to start like making some kind of lunch or dinner or snack or something like that. Meanwhile, in the background, you got a prosperity gospel televangelist, which 90% of them are, if not more, right, in the background. And you're picking up concepts on spirituality through the TV like this and the radio. Right? So whatever means of communication, magazines, whatever. So you get this whole mishmash of things. And if it makes sudden sense to you, like this is what happened with Earl Hickey, right? I explained in the beginning, part of the premise of the show was this guy who was in a hospital and he had a TV, so he was trapped, right? He's trapped in front of his TV and he's watching this talk show, just like I'm talking about right here. And a guy being interviewed, or a guy doing the interviewing, I don't know, Carson Daly is his name, but I don't know jack shit about the dude. I don't know the first thing about this guy, right? He's the one who mentions about karma. Karma is this spiritual concept that Earl Hickey takes in, and boom, we've got the premise for an entire TV show that runs for four seasons, right? Just like that. Just like that. But that's an example of how quick something like that happens. A spiritual concept enters into our head, and it kind of takes a hold in our psyche and becomes a part of who we are, becomes a part of our worldview. And a lot of it's mishmash. See, we got to really think it through. We have to have really a solid core base of beliefs and then add to it as we go. And if things just doesn't mesh up, like I'm Christian and this idea of karma does not mesh with my Christian understanding. Therefore, it is immediately discarded. It does not become a part of what I believe, who I am, what my worldview is, and what my place in the afterlife will eventually become. It has no place in it. But we need to have that solid, true, pure foundation to build off of. Now, in Earl Hickey's case, what's he building from? He's starting his spiritual walk from a misunderstanding of karma. He's got a basic ambition tied to it of really just getting rid of his bad luck and living a more amenable life, right? But these things change as we pursue our spirituality. If Earl Hickey was to ever become an Orthodox deacon by chance some 20 years down the road, it all begins with this moment in a hospital where he learned something about karma and he started pursuing spirituality, started pursuing truth, started pursuing faith, started learning theological concepts. It has a beginning, so it's not all bad, right? Not all bad at all. As long as we start to look at this, but we got to look seriously, and I'll give the character Earl Hickey credit. He really does, with his limitations, look very seriously at what's going on with this really blossoming relationship with God is what's happening there, right? The show is not going to express it that way. Don't hold on to your seat, you know? You've got to read in between the lines and see it. So what I'm talking about here is the way that this provincial spirituality, this trail mix of religious theological concepts build up and become like the fragments slapped together of a religion of our own device, right? We're Americans. We are apt to do things our own way. The individuality is good to a point, and then sometimes it exceeds its purpose, right? Almost always. I should say, in all of us, at times, the purpose of our individuality, the goodness of it, becomes excessive. When it comes to spiritual concepts, a lot of us are really in it for what I was calling the blessings before, the prosperity, right? The wealth. We want to see evidence in a God that we choose, a God that will make us better than everybody else. This was the failing of the Talmudists, right? The Pharisees back in the times of in the gospel era, right? They were amongst a separation of Jews apart from their own Messiah, which included zealots, right? Zealots. Judas Iscariot was a zealot. Simon the Zealot was a zealot, but he came out of it. Judas Iscariot never really did. Iscariot was a name, it was kind of like a family name, a tribal name of a particular brand of zealots. And what the zealots were, it was more of a political thing than a religious thing, but these things all tie together with the failings we have with God, right? What the zealots did in gospel times, what they represented back then, what they represent right now also, is the desire for a Messiah, the desire for a God that's going to make my people the greatest people and make all others subservient, right? It's always about, this is what I'm trying to say, it's always about what can your God do for you? God, what does God do for me? That's what makes God great, right? But no, it's not. It's what I do for God. So we get that the egocentricity rocking and rolling in our psyche and in our soul, and we're already back asswards. And this has been the problem since Cain killed Abel, right? It's just always been that way. We've always had that element in and amongst us. So you get all these wacky concepts, we make our own religions out of them. We don't really connect the dots. We don't eliminate the belief in one thing because something new comes in and makes sense, even though it's kind of contrary, right? We just somehow make it all mesh together and work. You could believe in this hokey bullshit and this counter hokey bullshit simultaneously somehow. Why? It's a marriage of convenience is what it is. You just spin your wheel, whatever you need to believe at a given time to allow you to do things, right? Here's where morality comes into it, for example. You have a belief about morality, say you're kind of like a half-assed father. You got some kids, you're paying child support some at a time. You're more like an uncle. You show up in their lives, maybe, maybe not, for like birthdays and graduations and shit like that, right? You're kind of semi-absentee father. A part of you really cares about them to some extent, but a part of you is negligent also, right? And you may have certain beliefs when it comes to like raising daughters up. You know, all of a sudden, you know, it's probably best if you stay a virgin until you get married, you know. But then on the other hand, as far as you're concerned, you may find it okay to go to bed with a 12-year-old girl in the trailer park. See what I'm saying? These two things don't jive, but for the matter of convenience, you will just select whichever fits your situation. It allows you to do ultimately what it is that you want to do. And again, here's the egocentricity. It's about me. It's about me. It's about me. It's about me. So a trail mix of spiritual concepts, a self-made Frankenstein religion, tends to be what a lot of Americans actually go by, believe it or not. You know, there's no way to enumerate that. But I just know. I just know in my experience with people, my personal experience with myself, with other people, before we really come to terms with our honest pursuit of that walk of redemption with Jesus Christ, hand in hand, heart in heart, we're usually dealing with some kind of disparate amalgam of theological concepts that we have allowed to slap together. Until we get into that actual true walk of redemption, we are not challenged to actually change ourselves, or to be changed ourselves. We don't really do the changing. God does the changing, right? That's what the sanctification is, right? Redemption begets sanctification, and it's a big deal. It's a big deal, but we never really have the challenge to change as long as we have belief systems that don't really stand for anything. It allows us to do what thou will, right? Like Aleister Crowley, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. We can believe something very Christian in one hand, and then we could try to believe something very, for example, Talmudist on the other hand. They both sound good, and they both seem to fit particular situations, but you know what? They're like oil and water. They don't go together. And if they don't go together, it's incongruous, and you don't really have anything. You have a whole lot of nothing happening there. It's a bastardized faith, right? That's how the bastardization of Christianity hurts us from the inside out, you know? On a political, geopolitical, worldwide basis, an interfaith basis, it hurts everything, the whole world from the outside in. But from the inside out, this is how we are corrupted, right? Christianity actually is conceptually solid. Morally solid. And if you stand by that, if you stand by your actual Christianity, you will be forced to change to it, not change it to you. Okay? Capiche? Well, that's a lot right there. That was a lot right there. But part of the trail mix of concepts, you know, like I see. And what Earl Hickey is doing with the karma is really closer to a thing that happened at that same period of time, right? It was actually this DVD movie that came out, and then it was followed up in book form. Some Australian woman, her name was Rhonda Byrne. I do not know the first or slightest thing about this person at all, right? But I was introduced to the movie, and this is a year or so. Well, this was about half a year before I came to faith, right? Before I was brought down on my knees before Christ and entered into my Christian walk, right? So the summer before the fall, really 3-4 months, I think, not even six. It's called The Secret, right? It came out in 2006. I saw it in 2007, and then I rejected it flatly, and then I came to faith, like I said, a couple of months thereafter, to Christian faith, on my own volition, without the help of anybody. Strangely enough, that's another story. It's a long one. It's a good one. To me, an important one. But yeah, it was called The Secret, and the idea about it is, it's not exactly what Earl was doing with karma. Now, karma had that premise about morality in it, the doing good. You know, good begets good, evil begets evil. There's that sort of thing going on. The Secret, on the other hand, while it sort of kind of involved that, right, in a sense that what you put out to the universe comes back to you, right? You follow what I'm saying? And when I say universe, put it in quotes. Universe is a anti-religion, anti-Christ way of saying God without saying God. People who don't want to admit that there's a God use the word universe. Like there's just a mystical, mystery black hole out there, all powerful, right? That you throw your ideas out to and it comes back to you manifested, right? And this is what The Secret becomes, a manifestation, as does Earl Hickey's idea of karma, right? You do good, and good happens. What's the good that happens? It's a manifestation of things that make you happy. Egocentricity, right? The misconception of blessing all over again. But there is this relation going on between Earl's concept of karma and this DVD. Sensation. It really was a phenomenon. It was all over the place. All people in their 30s and up were basically, maybe even in their 20s, were being hit with this thing. It was like somebody would get a DVD and just pass it around. I don't know where the success of it all came from. It must have been speaking to people at their most base levels, right? Because what you do now with this secret, right? The secret, I guess, is like the secret of getting what you want. You know, it's prosperity gospel without the Bible, without Jesus Christ. And I'll get into prosperity gospel shortly hereafter. The big secret of the universe is that if you really, really want something, you really, really focus on it, it'll manifest. The quote-unquote universe will pick up your vibration. And if you're really, fully, wholly intent, that's what a W, wholly, right? On acquiring whatever this object of desire is, your desire for it will be matched by the universe. And if the desire is great enough on both ends, it will manifest. So let's just say, just to kick the tires on the whole concept, I've always puttered around in lesser vehicles, right? You know, hoopty this and hoopty that. You know, before I got my F-150 mobile studio, I was driving around in a 2003 Chevy S10 ZR2, which is the nicest S10, right? The uppity one. Still an S10, right? Four-wheel drive, off-road package, all that. It was kind of good and kind of cool. It was freaking 16 years old, and it was just a small truck. Small trucks are meaningless in Texas. Now, I bought it up in Jersey, where a small truck had purpose. Down here, you need it. You need a full size and a trailer, right? Because it's Texas, it's Texas. But anyway, without getting into that, I always got to throw something about Texas in there, right? Let's not get lost in all this California shit, this Van Nuys Valley stuff and Salton Sea stuff. We got to always reel it back into Texas. Keep it real. Reel it in and keep it real, right? So I focus on, let's say, Mercedes-Benz. I could give a shit, all right? Don't get all uppity about it. I'm just using it as an example involving status, right? Mercedes-Benz is a status symbol. So I really want to just change in my life my lowly status as a beat-up, all hail-dented Chevy S10 driver. And I want a Mercedes-Benz, right? And I want it so bad. Why? To prove to myself that I'm more than it shows. To prove that God favors me. To attract women into my life, you know? So every kind of ambition that I could possibly have, from my balls to my brain, can just be put in to the desire of acquiring this one key element that seems like the linchpin that would put everything together for me, right? So I focus on this Mercedes, and I focus on this Mercedes, and I do everything. I plan my life about what it's going to take to acquire that Mercedes-Benz. How do I adjust my budget to start saving the money that I need? Where can I make contacts who can give me loans to help me get this thing? Are there clubs that I could join of Mercedes people who could tell me everything there is to be about Mercedes? And I spend my time around people who are all also involved with Mercedes-Benz. And then my whole brain becomes consumed 24 hours a day with the thoughts of Mercedes-Benz. And 24 hours a day includes 8 hours of sleep where I'm dreaming about Mercedes-Benz, because that's all I'm putting into my head all day. And I'm focused on it, I'm focused on it, I'm focused on it. You're probably going to end up with a Mercedes someday when you're like that, because it's all you care about. It's not really a manifestation of the universe. It's a manifestation of your own will. You see what I'm saying? And the if factor, IF, the if factor in the whole thing is the amount of your desire. If these things do not happen, well, your desire really wasn't there. So there's always an out for these quote-unquote gurus. I almost F-bombed right there. I almost did, right? I didn't even get the F. I just got the eh, and then I caught myself. But I do not like these quote-unquote guru, that's G-U-R-U type of people. Again, another Hindu reference, right? And all of this stuff comes out of these California cults, all these ideas. Why? Because the hippies in the 60s, it all started with those shitheads back then. The Stivics, remember the Stivics, right? Stivic's grandfather and even their parents, right? They were the hippies back then in California, and they got into that all Maharishi, the meditations, transcendental meditation stuff. You know, the Beatles and all these rock stars were going over to India and smoking the hooch and hanging out with this guru, this yogi. And then, you know, it all comes back to California, and then these guys become like these messianic figures unto themselves and then to others somehow who buy into their shit. And there's always somebody, and plenty of them, right, who buy into all this crap. So these messianic figures, they call themselves gurus, you know. It started with transcendental meditation groups. And then it just became every kind of California cult imaginable. It drives me up the wall, right? Really silly stuff. And it's not removed in any way from prosperity gospel. Okay, I mentioned that before, the prosperity gospel. The idea that the blessings are prosperous. It's all about getting that Mercedes Benz, right? God loves you, and you know God loves you if you are successful. If you fail to be successful, well, you have failed God in some way. There's your religion. Now, you could bring Jesus and the Bible into it, then it's called prosperity gospel, or you can exclude the name of Christ from that, which I wish you would. Just exclude it altogether. Don't even pretend and bastardize that name. But if you're going to do it, right, that's taking the Lord's name in vain. If you're going to do it, all right, I'm calling you out, and anybody who ever gets to hear me is going to know the kind of asshole you are. And you're the same kind of asshole, whoever you are, as somebody who doesn't include the name of Christ in it, right? They don't want to attach themselves to Christ. They're not Christian. They know it. They're at least being that honest. The people that they're trying to pull the wool over their eyes on are secular as well, you know? All of this, Christ or not, right? In terms of prosperity, gospel or not, just prosperity, right? This is a discipline, or these are varieties of a similar discipline that are basically expressing your favor of, quote unquote, the universe in terms of your evidence of success. Evidence of success would be any kind of symbol of status, such as a Mercedes Benz, like I mentioned, such as an enormous mansion, like I mentioned, right? The evidence of status becomes your proof of God's favor. Raise your hand if you believe that to be true. If there's 100 of you listening deep down, I bet you 85 of you believe that to be true. At least. Okay? And a lot of you are Baptists that go to church every week. A lot of you are Roman Catholics who go to church every week. Certainly Jews. Hell, that's what their religion is based on when you really bring it all down. What can God do for me? It's this whole battle between Messiah and Mammon. You can't serve two masters. I expect I'll get into that sooner. You know what? I will get into that. I'll get into that right now. What I mean to say is, like, this whole karma thing with Earl Hickey, right? And his whole secret thing from that Aussie woman, Rhonda Byrne. The whole prosperity gospel thing. And other things I haven't even mentioned yet, right? But they're on the same lines, and I'll probably get into some of it. But I want to talk about this cannot serve two masters the theological concept of Jesus Christ before I mention anything further, okay? Because I'm just trying to bring some additional and deeper and more meaningful context into all this stuff, right? But what I'm talking about, all these things have in common is this constant focus on selfish desire. It's plain and simple. It's plain and simple. Christian Zionists, Messianic Jews, all right? I know this from hanging out. I told you about these trailer park Bible groups, okay? I was intermeshed with these kind of people and this kind of mentality, and I was always arguing with these people, right? Always. Because they're ridiculous. They're always looking for, quote unquote, blessings. Blessings, blessings. Bless you. Be blessed. Be, you know? But what their idea of blessing is this evidence of God's favor in material things, which is very ironic because I was dealing with trailer park people that had no evidence of success in their life. But I guess they wanted it so bad that they were trying the methodology similar to this quote-unquote The Secret DVD, you know? Just the will for it will eventually make it manifest, right? And if it doesn't, then what? Just like the prosperity gospel. Your faith wasn't strong enough. Your desire, your will wasn't strong enough. It's always the same bullshit with these people, with these hucksters. Right? It drives me nuts. Matthew 6, okay? We're still, all right, still in the Sermon on the Mount I had mentioned earlier before. Matthew 6, and the verse was, what was it, 24? Yeah, Matthew 6, 24. Let me read this to you. One verse. No man can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon, okay? Two masters. Two potentials, really, broken down. We conflate things. We confuse things. We make it look like there's so much variety to believe in this world. We're really, it comes down to two things. It comes down to God Almighty, the creator of all things, and it comes down to our own personal desire. Those are the two masters that we can choose. And this, the verbiage in this verse that Jesus Christ uses in his teaching, he's comparing God and mammon. What's mammon? Simply stated, it's treasure, riches. It's related to avarice, which is greed. Okay? So you're talking about wealth. You're talking about prosperity. That is one potential Lord to serve, and the other one is God Almighty himself. And that's it. There are no others. You could say you worship Satan. You could find any God in the Greek pantheon to align yourself with and to pray to learn from. You could pick any of the myriad of Hindu gods, since we keep on bringing up Hinduism, right? It doesn't matter, because all they're about is serving your need every single time, which means it all comes back to your desire, right? When God Almighty doesn't give you what you want, you are getting disciplined from a good, good father. But when you don't like that discipline, you turn to somebody who can get you what you want. I did this shit, you know, when I was growing up. I always, you know, the children of divorced parents play their mother against their father to get what they want out of that deal. And then the parents are always sympathetic and guilty, right? They're problem in their guilt for failing in that relationship and leaving these kids into such a fragmented existence, a broken psyche of a broken family, right? That they all capitulate to the desires of the kid, and the kid easily can just play one against the other and come out of it with a brand new car upon his graduation from high school, for example, you know, or any kind of gift, any kind of desire at all. You could play your parents against each other till somebody finally comes around and gives you what it is you want. I know I did it, and I know other people do it too, right? You play God against the devil in your head. God is the good father that gives you good discipline. It's going to make you a good person, and you don't like it because you're a crybaby brat. You can turn to the devil and see what the devil's got to offer instead, right? And I don't know what that looks like person to person. I know that it's pretty much that simple in my way of thinking when I was young, when I was a teenager, when I was a young adult, even sober. It wasn't even a matter of being on drugs or anything like that, even sober, you know? I was being taught about the quote-unquote higher power, God with a capital G, and all this stuff. And at the same time, you know, when I really felt alone and I wanted a woman, I could just kind of turn the other way and say, hey, what you got for me, devil? or evil or whatever, you know, darkness of the universe. You can call it all kinds of things. And that's the point I'm trying to make here. Whatever you call it, it ends up being your own desire. That's all it is. It's every time. You can't serve yourself and serve God. You can't do it. I explained this before already. It just doesn't work that way. It does not work that way. We are flawed and we are on a path to redemption, right? And if we don't take that course and if we don't experience sanctification, when the afterlife comes, we're not going to be qualified to enter into heaven. We are going to be condemned to hell. And that's not a punishment. We're just not taking the reward of our faith. Because we're really not taking up faith to be rewarded by in the first place, right? We're born condemned. Sorry to say it, but it's true. We need to change something in ourselves in order to aspire to God and eternal life. There's no threat there. There's no punishment involved with it. You get what you're born into. Jesus Christ is the rescue from that condemnation. We fail to see it that way. We look at it, the discipline of our good Father, God Almighty, as punishment, when it's actually the cure for the real ailment of humanity. We need to get bigger than we are, I tell you what. Every single one of us. That's a lot of big, heady stuff, right? So how do I manage to talk about the failings of California coupled with trailer parks and trailer trash and Earl, you know? And I come up with all this, right? This is the runaway train of thought. You never know where it's going to go. You never know where it's going to go. I was talking about these other related type of prosperity. What do we say, you know? There's prosperity gospel, and then there's prosperity gospel without the gospel. They're all the same thing, right? One of them has a Jesus Bible flavor to it, and the rest of them don't, but they're all the same. There's a secular version. There's a Christian version. It's all the same crap. You know, when it's about prosperity, I tend to call them white-collar cults, you know? And I don't even know how accurate that really is of a statement. But I one friend of mine in my past, who's a dear friend of mine, was a guy who turned me on to these two different things, right? And turned on ain't even the right way to put it, because I was turned off by it. This was a guy who was a Roman Catholic, right? And, by appearances, devout Roman Catholic. He was a guy, AA guy. He was teaching me how to pray, how to get on my knees and pray and things like that. Always trying to bring me to God. But then something happened in his life. A change came along, right? And all of a sudden, now he's the guy who's bringing me to these white-collar cults. You know, he introduced me, for example, to Anthony Robbins, right? Tony Robbins, who made the whole cassette tape series on the self-mastery. And he did all these infomercials, and he would do all these seminars, right? A California guy, right? And it's all about this, you know, self-improvement type of stuff. And also this thing, EST, right? EST. It was Erhard Seminars Training. That was the old 70s word, early 80s word for what this was, EST. But this Erhard Seminar, it's a German sounding dude, but it wasn't. He was like Werner Erhard was his fake name. He was some kind of Jew. Right? He had a very, very Jewish name. I don't have it. I don't remember what the hell it was. But he got into some kind of sexual scandals, you know, with all these people he was zombifying who were chasing after their Mercedes Benzes and mansions and whatnot. And, you know, the group of investors around him, rather than just giving up on him and throwing the whole thing away and moving on with their lives, they decided to take it up and rebrand it, repackage it, and keep it flying. And it was called Landmark Forum in that iteration. And that's what I got introduced to by this friend of mine, right? Close friend of mine. But this is where the relationship really started to flounder. It just shit went right at this point. That was a white collar cult. That's what it was called by so many people. Now, if you publicized anything that criticized this landmark forum, landmark education, this EST in any way, shape, or form. Boy, they had a legal team that was going to come down on you. I don't care how small you are, right? I'm even a little bit, should I even talk about this shit now, right? This is years and years and years ago. It still exists. So if the word ever got back to them, holy shit, you know? Holy shit. But that's how they were about it, right? Very protective. You couldn't say anything derogatory. They were ready to sue everybody for everything all the time, and litigious as all hell, and that it all just stunk. I mean, look, I'm going to tell you, they had orientation, which was nothing more than a group hypnosis session. It was completely obvious. They fill the room, right? Here's just an example. And I've seen this happen in the Protestant churches, by the way, too, all right? Group hypnosis is done like this. You get a group of people. You get all these people into this orientation to come in, right? And it costs money. A lot of people are sponsored by people who are already part of this whole landmark education thing. Or in my case, you got people who promise to sponsor you. They'll pay your way. It was like $300, which was a lot of money at that time. And it's like this whole like weekend, like 2.5-day seminar thing. You're really immersed in it. Why? Because you have to be immersed in it. They're steeping you. They're giving you no options like to even think for yourself. That's part of the whole hypnosis, group hypnosis factor. So you end up with a group of these people in the orientation also taking part in it and pretending to be in orientation, or people who've already been through it. There's a pyramid scheme involved with it. There's levels that you go into where you start making money at this whole racket. I'm serious. All right, this is California cult 101 shit. It's basically what they all do. They dress them up in certain ways, right? And they don't wish to be called that because the negative connotations drive people away, which means less money. It's all a scam. It's all bullshit, right? But what they do in this room now, you got all these people. And amongst these people now, you got people who are getting their first doses of it. You got people who have brought them in, taking part in it. And then you also have people who are just part of like the management committee that put these seminars together. And they're plants in the crowd. And what happens is whatever the speaker up front is talking about, these are the people that are cheerleaders. They rah, 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 rah. They applaud everything, you know, like seals. Wah, 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 wah. And that becomes contagious. See, when you're in a group, if people start applauding, you start applauding politely just so you don't stand out in the crowd. Because you're a pussy faggot, right? You don't know how to stand up and say, this is bullshit, like I did, right? Walk away from it. So what ends up happening is people start buying into it. It becomes like this tidal wave of acceptance to the presentation. It's horrific, but that's how this shit works. What a terrible thing. And I was so pissed. I was so pissed that I went through even half of it, right? I was so pissed that my friend subjected me to it. And then I was pissed because he wouldn't even pay for it after he said he would pay for it. And all kinds of problems started with this crap, right? And still he was trying to rope me into it as the months and years went by. I like to try to forget about this crap. He has passed away, you know, and I remember how important he was in my life up to that point. But from that point forward, something changed. I know what the something was, and I just don't want to say it right here, right now, out of respect for the widow left behind who may hear this at some point in time. But it was that relationship. Oh, I don't even want to say it. But that's where the whole materialistic angle of this guy's existence just kicked into gear. And everything changed from that point, right? This whole self-serving thing that I was talking about, this constant focus on selfish desire, and then bringing other people into it like that. You know, I needed something in my life, but that was not what I needed. I did not need selfish focus and desire to be the principal aim of my being. I needed exactly the opposite of that. And with God's willingness, somehow, I meandered my way out of that situation, away from those people, onto a course unknown, within only a handful of months, and finding myself at the foot of the cross. Without a preacher around me, without a pastor holding my hand, just me and God direct, it's really hard to explain. I mean, well, it takes a while. I can't explain it. And I'm not going to do it right now, right? Biggest moment of my life happened right there. That was the Super Bowl of my existence that very day. It was Nashville, Tennessee. I will not soon forget it, right? So many of these damn cults, you know, and I lump Tony Robbins in with it. You know him from selling all his cassettes if you're Generation X. He was on the infomercials all the time. He probably still is. I just don't watch TV to know it. But he had seminars also, and I don't know how they went. I never went to one. They were very expensive. They were weekend long. You traveled to Hawaii. And I would have to say it was the same kind of practice there as I experienced with that EST Landmark shit, right? They probably set it up the same way, had plants in the crowd, all that stuff. Hey, you get into that guy's stuff, he's buying all his shit. He has different levels of shit to purchase, you know, advanced education and la-da-da-da-da. It's all the same crap. It's all scam, you know? You know, because I'm telling you. If you're listening to me, you know now if you didn't know before. So many California cults. You got to ask the question, do seminars actually constitute cults, right? Do they actually constitute cults? Let's define cult, you know, what a cult is. Dictionary definition. Now, I know people struggle with this word, right? This word cult. It gets mixed connotations. I don't know how to explain it, really. But let's go with a dictionary definition and take it from there. Let's see what we get, okay? Here, a religion or religious sect, okay? So first of all, there's a relationship to religion when it comes to cult, according to this dictionary, right? A religion or religious sect generally considered to be extremist or false. Okay, so now you're talking about a religion or religious sect, which is either extremist, well, they're not mutually exclusive, but extremist or false, right? Let's just go with false. It's a false religion, okay? A cult is a false religion. Now, the rest of it is, with its followers often living in an unconventional manner under the guidance of an authoritarian, charismatic leader, right? Charismatic. You see that word, charismatic? When I hear that word charismatic, you know what I think of? Pentecostalism. And you know what I think of when I think of Pentecostalism? I think of prosperity gospel. One begets the other somehow, some way. They're not exactly the same thing. But one seems to... They're like kissing cousins. Somehow. And I don't know. I don't know all the how of it. But, you know, the linkage is probably this whole charismatic leader guy, right? The charismatic leader guy. Who is authoritarian? Pretty much without exception, you know. And if he's not authoritarian, there's some kind of body, a governing body around him that is, right? But make no mistake about it. This is a false religion authoritarianism. Wow, I've never struggled with that word before. Authoritarianism and charisma, a charismatic leader. All right, so you get the cult leader, right? That's what we're talking about. They're the cult leader. So this definition has a definite religious bent to it. But now we got to define what religion is, right? Because, like I said, I made that difference, a distinction earlier between prosperity gospel and prosperity not gospel. Still the same basic premise, you know, of willing the universe to bring into man's manifestation the objects of your desire, right? One has the Jesus Bible angle tied into it, the other one doesn't, but it's still the same ridiculous practice, right? But you see, they're the same practice. One will be considered religious. Why? Because it's got that Jesus Bible bend to it. But it's a false religion. It ain't the truth. So is it a cult? And what about the other one? If the one's a cult, if prosperity gospel is a cult, why isn't the other one a cult? Well, it's not a religion. It's the same damn premise. And let me show you something about religion and anti-religion, okay? I'm going to define religion now for you. Religion, same. A dictionary, right? So a dictionary definition of religion. The belief in and reverence for a supernatural power or powers regarded as creating and governing the what? Drum roll, please! universe, right? Remember I was talking about, my name is Earl, Earl Hickey, karma. And what is his karma? He looks up to the sky when he's trying to talk to karma. And who's he talking to? This mysterious universe, all power, right? Power of the universe. And anybody who wants to try to not be religious about their religious or their cultish premise, right, is just going to regard the power of the universe or the universe, or I should say regard God as this universal, unnamed, unknown power. People pray to the universe. People send their desires out to the universe in hopes that they will manifest back here to the earth in three dimensions, right? The belief in and reverence for supernatural power or powers regarded as creating and governing the universe. So you've got that universe in there, then there's a creation factor of it and a governing factor of it. Now, non-religious, quote-unquote non-religious people, right? Let's just call them what they are. Freaking antichrist, right? They don't want to acknowledge God as a creator. Atheists, agnostics, things like that. And then other anti-religions. Because even atheists and agnostics are religions unto themselves, in a way. Whew, I can explain all this to you. I really can. Atheist is easy. Their religion is science, but it really boils back down to their own base desires. It's always going to be that way. The reverence is for the people that can provide that, right? We think of ourselves, it's a humanist idea. We think humanity is great. It's all-knowing, all-serving. It can discover anything. It can figure out anything. It solves all problems. This is why people give themselves over to the government, for example. They think the government can cure everything because they really believe in the power of people. They don't ride on the same highway that I commute on, where all people suck, right? So I don't understand the logic there. Obviously, all people suck, and you don't want to put anything into people's hands if you can avoid it, right? You really don't. You really don't. But anyway, the belief and reverence for a supernatural power or powers regards creating and governing. So the atheists, the agnostics, the humanist types, they have an aversion to the singular creator notion, right, of God. They don't know what created everything. They don't know where it all started. You've heard the Big Bang Theory, right? But that has no beginning to it either. It's just really, it's something else that you could say instead of saying God. Just like the universe. You could pray out to the universe, right? You could pray out to the Big Bang Theory. Of course, an atheist doesn't believe in prayer because the atheist doesn't have the belief, theoretically, in the supernatural power. Of course, throw them in a foxhole and have somebody get blown up next to them by a grenade. They'll believe in God quick, right? You know that, and I know that. You know that. Ain't no atheists in a foxhole, right? Ain't no atheists in war. We know this. We know this. It's a whole bunch of bullshit, and I don't mean to go off on the tangent of it. With the agnostics, on the other hand, really, they're just ignorant. They're ignorant. You know, at best, they're ignorant. They just don't want nothing to do with the spiritual because why? Their pursuit is in the material. They live in this 3D world, and it's all about the get. It's all about the take, right? Agnostic is an abandonment, basically, of the supernatural. It's not to say that you don't believe that there's a God or not. It's not to say that you believe that there's, you know, spirit beings, angels, demons, and whatnot. Not to say about the afterlife. You really just simply don't give a shit about it, right? It's all out there. You don't give a shit. What ends up happening is you become, as an agnostic, the poster child for Frankensteining your own religion together. Piecemeal, right? Trail mix, like I was talking about before. A little bit of this, a little bit of that. And you just work it in to some kind of convenience that fits your moments and allows you to be you, right? Meaning, you know, whatever suits your mood will fly. Meaning, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law, because you're Satanist like Aleister Crowley deep down. This is how it all boils down every single time. It's incredible, right? It's incredible, right? So that's the creation aspect. But then the governing of the universe. See, everybody has some kind of belief of some kind of order, right? There's a universal order, and there's something at the top of the pyramid. We don't know what to call it in a lot of cases. I mean, I call it God. God Almighty, creator of the universe, right? The triune Godhead, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. There's a lot of proper names that you can call it. You know, the God of Abraham, right? The God of Moses, a lot of different ways that we can go. The God of Melchizedek, right? We could go on and on with some of these righteous men of the Old Testament, right? So anyway, what we're talking about is cults and cults religion to or a relation to religion, right? And what I'm saying is things that do not necessarily appear to be a religion on the surface really are, right? Atheism is a religion. Agnosticism is usually, it's like the anti, how do you say it? The anti-religion version of Protestantism. It's what Protestantism, let me start again. Agnosticism is the anti-religion version of what Protestantism is to the true religion of God Almighty. This is where everything becomes shattered and denominated into millions and millions of little tiny personal religions, individuality, like I was talking about before. A Protestant Frankensteins his Christianity together. Even those who follow somebody else, which becomes what? A cult leader, right? It really is. It really is. Every preacher around that's a Protestant is, in effect, a cult leader of a sort. There's almost no way to get around it except for the very specific elements of peculiar cultures and that authoritarian aspect of it. But when you belong to a church, you're going to find it to be, at least in a small regard, authoritarian. There is a boss, and there are rules. There is a society, there's a culture, there is the cultural strictures involved. Some are written, some are spoken, some of them are unspoken and unwritten, but you know they're there, right? There's a cloud of authoritarianism in these societies. So, well, I'm going off on a lot of tangents right here, right? But what I'm talking about is agnosticism actually ends up itself being a religion anyway. It's just hidden in the fact that it's a zillion religions, right? This is me Frankensteining my own religion together piecemeal into trail mix out of disparate theological ideas that I just pick up anywhere along the way and just throw into the soup of my beliefs, right? And it becomes this crazy worldview that's really nothing but my desires having a way to justify, you know, spirituality and immorality in the same breath. So I'm the Frankenstein, and the next guy's a Frankenstein, and the next million guys after that, Frankenstein. They cobble together this fictitious set of religious beliefs and practices, and nobody really understands that they have a religion. Everybody's got some religion. Whatever you believe, whatever you don't believe, it adds up to being your religion. It simply is. There's really no avoiding the fact. You're on board with God Almighty, the creator of all things, or you're not. The default is you're not. This is what I was saying before. We're born condemned. We're not being punished for our sins. This is who we are. We're people, and we need salvation. The good thing that comes along and saves us, the giver, like I was talking about earlier, right? The giver is God. The taker is the devil. You align with the devil, who wants you to stay on your course to hell. I wanted to say the natural course to hell, but it isn't natural. It's an abomination. We are a corrupt being. Oh, it's so heavy. I'm talking about video games and trailer parks. And how did I get to this? I'm talking about a TV show from the 2000s. How did I get to this? Insane. Woo! Woo! I'm wooing even. I can't even keep up with it all. But this all leads to one final thing that I want to do in this part, and then we'll move on to part three. All right? Very chit-chatty today, very talkative. I didn't see this coming, but here it is. In the video game Grand Theft Auto number 5, talking about this character that my wife has named Earl, so we call him Earl, who's really Trevor Phillips as a character, but when we're playing and rampaging, he's Earl. He's Earl. Right? We got the tale of two Earls going on here. There's Earl, and then there's Earl Hickey from My Name is Earl. Right? Going back to Earl from Grand Theft Auto, something really weird happened the other night, you know? And I missed it. I didn't see it coming. I was just, you know, you could fly a helicopter in this game. And what you've got is this open world that is very representative of Southern California, mostly Los Angeles, right? And the detail is magnificent. The technology is already, you know, going back 10, 15 years of age. And it's just still a mind blower how detailed, how much stuff there is. It just seems like an endless environment to explore. And it's not like they're patching on more stuff as time goes by. This is how they made the game to be. Really incredible. You got to give these guys a pat on the back. Rockstar Games, just for what they do. They're supposedly working on a sixth one. I don't know. It's due out maybe in the next year or two. I don't know what the whole story is to it. I want to play it, but I'm not going to be able to play it until I get a console that will be able to handle it, which I don't intend to do anytime soon. But I can't imagine how incredible that game's going to be after 10 years have gone by, right? Anyway, a little side jag right there. Credit where credit is due. It is an incredible game. Within that incredibility, within that seemingly endless detail, I'm flying around in a helicopter, right? That's what it is. I got a helicopter, I'm flying around in it. This is what Earl does sometimes, right? We're flying around in a helicopter, and I just seen this thing, like this outcropping on the side of this huge mountain, like a fortress, like an old, like a cavalry fort, like F Troop, right? Yeah, the Apaches, you know, an F Troop, and they had those, you know, those forts with the vertical wooden piles all around, you know, and then they had like the lookout towers made of the same wood in the corners, the big gate that opened up in the middle of it, right? The Fort Apache type of fort. This is like an outcropping out of this huge mountain that I never saw. I didn't know it was there. I had no call to know it was there, but there it was. So I had to just land my chopper right down in the middle of it all and take a look around and see what it was. And I get out, and the blades of the chopper are spinning around. They're starting to slow down. Boom, 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 boom. So that sound goes away. And then I hear, like, this creepy, like, Tibetan kind of Buddhist, I don't know, I guess you'd call it music, sounds in the background. So they're coming out of some kind of speaker system within this fortress, right? And I'm walking around, there's a couple people over there just talking, and a couple over there. So I walk over here. These people are just chit-chatting. They don't pay me no mind. I walk by. They're in front of a building. You know, it's like a log cabin sort of building out there. You know, it's not exactly a log cabin. It's some kind of just building within the fortress complex made of wood. And, you know, I just get up on the porch and I walk around. Oh, they got some ammo and guns and stuff like that. A little bit here just to grab and snatch for my bother. And I walk around more just see if there's anything else I can find, you know. And I go down all the way to the front. There's a front gate to it with the guard tower that looks just like F Troop and everything. A guard is up in it. There's another one down the way. You can see the guy up there. I'm standing there. There's another group, 2, 3, 4 people hanging around. There's one old dude, I mean old, like 70-something, 80-something, all saggy skin and shit like that. Full Monty. He's standing there buck naked. His schlong almost down to his knee. Like, what the hell is this? Right? It turns out it's some kind of weird nudist cult. And as you walk around, really look at the people, I didn't know, it's just like walking by. Most of them are at least half naked. Some of them are full on naked occasionally. You know, when I say half naked, they'll have a t-shirt on, they'll have nothing down below. And most of them don't have a horse dick like that one guy did. Most of them got these little snossages. You couldn't even call it a dick. It's funny looking, right? They do a little pecker that just in the middle of all this fuzz and everything like that. But this is in this video game. I had no idea. They're called the altruist cult, right? And I don't know what their thing is. But I missed this. It actually was a part of Trevor Phillips, Earl's story, right? It was in the storyline, but I must have blew past it. Somewhere along the way, you find these little side missions. You meet these strange people on the side of the road who are in some kind of trouble, and you could choose to help them out or ignore them. When you go to help them out, certain one of these people, I think they call them strangers and freaks in the game, right? Certain ones of them, you are able to kidnap. And rather than help them out and then be rewarded however they may reward you, you can deliver them up to these weird altruist cult people to do whatever they do with them, right? And they'll give you like $1,000 or something like that when you bring these people up. And when you bring up four of them, you kind of complete that mission, and then all hell breaks loose. The cult turns on you and you got to fight them off. I never got to that point because I didn't know. When I figured this out, there was one side stranger and freaks thing that I hadn't completed. So I decided just to see what it's like. I went and did it, right? And it was this Italian girl, of all things, right? It was a daughter of some mafioso. And there was two guys, had her digging her own grave, and she was going to be buried alive in it out of vengeance for something her father did to these dudes, right? So you got this Italian princess who's about to be buried alive. So my job as Earl is to come up over the hill, see this, gun those two guys down, untie this girl and bring her to safety, right? So I do all that. I get her in my pickup truck and we start driving off. She makes a phone call, makes arrangements for somebody to meet her somewhere. I'm going to drive her out to there, but I got this option now that I can kidnap her and take her up to the altruist cult. All right, this is California. All right, this is California. Don't let that slip away. So I did it, right? I drive up the mountain. I did a winding mountain path. It's all rickety, and like you're always about to fall off the cliff and shit like that. Real crazy. You got to really like tiptoe up it and creep up it, and I'd be real careful. And I get all the way up to the front gate. The gate opens up, and this, you know, wacko hillbilly dude, dick hanging out, walks up, and he's got some kind of gun, and it just happens automatically. And the girl is being taken into this cult, and she made this whimpering sound, right? You just saved her life and gave her a new lease on life, and then you turned around and delivered her to these cult freaks. She made this whimpering sound that probably only a wounded puppy dog could make, and it chilled me to the bone. It's like, I just did this. It felt so real. I could walk around or ride around or fly around this whole Grand Theft Auto universe, you know, San Andreas, as they call it, this whole Southern California thing, and blow every single person to smithereens. But when I delivered this one particular one up into this crazy cult, that shook the fiber of my being. I don't even know how to explain it. That was so weird. I really felt bad about that. I got to explore that. That's something inside of me, and I really don't get it at this point in time. Maybe someday I'll understand it and I'll bring it up again.
This monologue is continued in the next episode, Chapter 00081, Earls of Wisdom, Part 3.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Arlen Monologics. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.